Good afternoon, everyone. Happy New Year. I am Hank Jones, and you are listening to Hank Jones Poly Sports here at Global Patriot Radio. We can be found on blogtalkradio.com, of course. We are here 7 days a week with seven shows. It's great to be here today, the first Wednesday of 2023, January the 4th. Hey, it's, you know, can't complain. It's been a good year so far, a couple days in. Got no complaints other than the usual. So anyway, if you come in here on any given day, you will hear a show from Global Patriot Radio. That starts Monday. I know the calendar starts on Sunday. Hank Jones's week doesn't start till Monday, like most people. Mondays at 6 p.m. Eastern time, you can listen to the Vito Esposito show featuring Vito and Big Al. Tuesdays, Eric with the Cross and Crescent discussion. And Eric actually returns this next Tuesday. He has been out and about, had some stuff going on, evidently. He's at 6 p.m. Eastern as well. He's been filled in. Paul Sutliff, I know, has filled in a couple times for him as well, and which brings us to Thursday. You know, I'm here on Wednesday. Thursday, Paul Sutliff is in with the Sutliffian Report, also 6 p.m. Eastern. So three out of the first 4 days, 6 p.m. Eastern, and then me starting at 5:30. Not bad. That's pretty consistent. Fridays, it gets a little wonky. Usually around noon, Andrew Herod with Conservative Casual Friday. And you should check always the showrunners on that. Come into the website and look for episodes, because sometimes, depending on what's going on with a show or with a personal thing, we don't always start at the time we say. Sometimes we change it up on a given week. And Andrew's pretty consistent with noon Eastern times, but I know there are times he's done different than noon. So check it out always. Saturday nights, rock solid, 10 p.m. to midnight Eastern time, Minister Usama Dakduk, assisted by the beautiful Christy with Revealing the Truth About Islam. I'll tell you what, now a lot of people say Saturday nights, that's why. When you get to be our age, folks, we don't all go out Saturday night carousing and whatnot. So it's a good listen. And also, of course, for you sports fans, that's an excuse not to watch a Big 12 or a Pac-12 game on Saturday night. You can say, no, sorry, honey, I can't watch UCLA versus Oregon State. Sundays, Eric is back, 3 p.m. Eastern, with sort of a continuation. He used to call it Real Interfaith Dialogue. He may still, but it's a continuation of his Cross and Crescent discussion. Always, blogtalkradio.com. Come in, look at the live button. When you click on that, you go down to the right and you'll see live, and it'll tell you who's chatting. Alternatively, you can follow the show, any of our shows. So if you follow one on any given day, you'll get notifications for all our shows. Pretty cool, huh? Yeah, you get an email notification. Now, to do that, you do have to have an account on Blog Talk Radio, but very simple, no money involved. So I urge you to go ahead and do it. I am here, of course, in the official Hank Jones Poly Sports Space Force Observation Outpost. A little Aussie was fed today, a little late. Mrs. Hank is over at Acoustic Hank Land. She's working, but she's working in a new endeavor. Mrs. Hank has switched jobs, getting back to something about which she has more passion. And she's doing some training for that. She's very sharp. So, yes, she needs training, but not usually on systems. She doesn't need training for how to do what she does. She's very good. Today's first Internet Laffy comes from Twitter. Arizona Cardinals quarterback Kyler Murray tweeted that he was blessed to play with the greatest wide receiver of all time, Larry Fitzgerald, in his rookie year. He then posted a photo. The problem, under that photo, Larry Fitzgerald responded with, "Thanks at K1. I think that's actually Brittany Griner, though. Hope you are doing well." It is a picture. Sure enough, it is a picture of Brittany Griner, who shares the ponytail design with Larry Fitzgerald, but little else. Damn, that is just, when I saw that is just priceless, no doubt. Let's get to the obits. Don't worry, we have more Laffy coming later. Last Thursday, we lost the world's greatest soccer player, Brazilian Pelé, born Edson Arantes do Nascimento. I knew that because once they did a Sports Illustrated article on him, and it showed his whole name, and for some reason I thought it was cool that I remembered it. He was featured for years on ABC Wide World of Sports montage. He would run after scoring a goal, then he would slide to his knees and cross himself and pray. And it was, you know, for years, every Saturday in Wide World of Sports, that was one of the images during their montage. That and the skier that wipes out, looks like off a ski jump, looks like he's got to be dead, and turns up on Johnny Carson's show. A couple months later, all he had was like a broken ankle or something. Anyway, Pelé, he literally was the game of soccer for decades. I mean, any U.S. person that was asked about soccer, about the only thing they could tell you was Pelé. Anyway, he passed away from colon cancer at age 82. And last Friday, we lost former Purdue and Jacksonville Jaguars and, I guess for a year, Dallas Cowboys defensive lineman Uche Nwaneri. He collapsed and died at the age of 38. No explanation or cause as of yet, but obviously 38 is far too young. We also lost a longtime newscaster, talk show host and interviewer and TV personality, I guess you'd say, Barbara Walters, died at home after several years of health issues, age 93. Yes, she was a lefty. Yes, she could be annoying, but she was also good at her job. She was an absolute icon. I mean, there's no doubting that. She became the first female co-host of the Today Show after the death of another icon, Frank McGee. Points against her, though, for helping create the absurdity that is The View. Yeah, negative points there. She's going to have to answer for that. Sorry, just call him as I see him. Saturday, on the last day of 2022, we lost former Pope or Pope Emeritus, Pope Benedict XVI at age 95. And then we also lost Anita Pointer of the legendary Pointer Sisters to cancer at age 74. She was actually preceded in death by two of her singing sisters, Bonnie and June. So there's only Ruth, I guess, is the only one left. Yeah, three out of the four. Sunday, the first day of 2023, we lost Gangsta Boo of the Oscar-winning rap group 3-6 Mafia. She was found dead in her home at age 43. No cause has been listed. That group won the Oscar for Best Original Song for 2005's Hustle and Flow, which featured Terrence Howard as a pimp and aspiring rapper. They won that for the song It's Hard Out Here for a Pimp. It's actually a great song. It really is. I like the song. And it captures a rather poignant moment in the movie. He has a pregnant girlfriend. He's got several of his hoes that live with him. And his pregnant girlfriend is sort of, you know, sort of mops the floor with her all the time. He doesn't treat her great, but he does love her. And so he gets her to sing the female part that I think was sang by Gangsta Boo originally for the movie. And she hears the song, then they play it back on tape. And the look on her face, you know, she thought so low of herself and was so down on herself. And then she heard herself singing and she just lights up. I mean, it's really a poignant part of the movie. And then Saturday, we also lost former Earth, Wind & Fire, or on Sunday, I'm sorry, Sunday, we also former Earth, Wind & Fire drummer Fred White to unknown causes at age 67. He was the half-brother of Maurice White and Vernon White, the original drummer and bass player. Then we lost Art McAnally, longtime NFL official, Hall of Fame official. He was 97. Monday, we lost American rally driver Ken Block in a snowmobile rollover accident at age 5. Yeah, snowmobiling's fun, but it can be dangerous. If you saw the thing on Jeremy Renner, he was not killed, but Jeremy Renner, a snow plow accident. So out in the West where they're getting all this snow, you got to be careful, folks. We also lost American restaurateur Buster Corley. He was the co-founder of Dave & Buster's. Apparently, he died by suicide, by gunshot. He was just 72. Then yesterday, we lost another American hero, Walter Cunningham. And no, somebody, I thought about this. It's not the kid that Scout beats up in To Kill a Mockingbird. This is Walter Cunningham, the astronaut. He passed away at age 90, complications from a fall. He was the last surviving member of Apollo 7. He served as the lunar module pilot on that flight. Now, that was the first Apollo mission. If you remember, actually remember, most of you don't, but In 1967, Apollo 1 was in a test and a fire aboard the spacecraft in test, and those three astronauts did not survive: Roger Chaffee, Ed White, and of course Gus Grissom, the second American into space. So they had several missions that only did some, not even orbital flight, but Apollo 7 was the first manned mission. He was also just the third civilian astronaut at NASA. Neil Armstrong was the first. He was a fighter pilot with the U.S. Marine Corps from 1953 to 1956. He flew 54 missions as a night fighter pilot in Korea. He retired from the U.S. Marine Reserve as a colonel in 1975. Godspeed, Walter Cunningham. Rest in peace, American hero. Ironically, that same day, we also lost James Baker, Brubaker, an American movie producer, to multiple strokes. He was 85. I say ironically, one of the films James Brubaker helped produce was The Right Stuff, featured the original Mercury program alongside the test pilot program, which then led, of course, to the Gemini, then the Apollo program, which is when Walter Cunningham was with that, with NASA. He was in the third round of astronauts. By the way, as there are potential issues with the Russian side of the International Space Station, SpaceX is being asked whether it could perform a rescue mission to the station if needed. Isn't that ironic? People trying to attack Tesla, going after Elon Musk on Twitter, but they're asking SpaceX if they can do a rescue mission. They're not even talking like a shuttle or an Artemis type of mission. They are strictly, I mean, they're going to SpaceX. That's enough for our obituaries this week. Don't forget, my friends, at Alliance Communications, Central Florida's 24-hour call center for messaging and answering services, medical clinic, hospital clinic, service company, survey company, information gathering services, kinds of work, very, very diverse in their offerings. They also work with remote staff. So if you're a remote staff type enthusiast, if you want a job where you work remotely, they can accommodate you. You can handle calls from all over the world, but you can also work from pretty much all over the world. Give them a call at 800-555-3738 or go to their website, alliancecommunications.com. They do great work. They really do. Another internet laughy, this one from the Babylon Bee. This one's hilarious. Thousands of Spirit Airlines passengers disappointed that their flights were not canceled. I've flown Spirit once. Oh, God. Ugh, it was not pretty. I mean, it's cramped. You pay for everything. You don't even get peanuts. Get to our stories. A fascinating find on Yahoo. It was reprinted from the New York Times. Now, it's fascinating because it is so brazen in its partiality, and it tells one so much about who not to trust in the Republican Party. It's about New York Congresswoman Elise Stefanik, who, after the ouster of Liz Cheney over her betrayal of the GOP and President Trump, took over the GOP's number three spot in the House. And it talks about how she completely reinvented herself, that she was a moderate Republican, but that she went all in on Trump. And it said she was sick of commuting to Washington from upstate New York and weary of dialing for campaign dollars. She was demoralized that Republican primary voters had spurned so many of the women she had helped persuade to run. She was annoyed that AOC had displaced her that fall in 2018 as the youngest woman ever elected to the House. AOC didn't show her the respect she felt was due. It was bigger than that, though. She crafted her brand as a moderate millennial. The future of hopeful, aspirational politics in America, as her mentor, Paul Ryan, would describe her in Time magazine. Yeah, now there's a first clue. Paul Ryan. That said, when Trump became president, she didn't like or respect him, that he was a whack job. But then she says, you don't know how hard this is. So she became too much to the right. She told friends she was thinking of joining Paul Ryan in retirement. And it says she embarked on one of the most brazen political transformations of the Trump era. With breathtaking speed and alacrity, Stefanik remade herself into a fervent Trump apologist, adopted his over-torqued style on Twitter, and embraced the conspiracy theories that animate his base. Allegations of dead voters casting ballots in Atlanta and unspecified irregularities involving voting machine software in 2020 swing states. Guess what? They're not conspiracy theories, and they haven't all been debunked. But in fact, none of them have been debunked. What's been debunked is the process. Said she now goes after the Democrats as the party of socialists, illegals, criminals, communist truth ministers, and media stenographers. And how I would answer that with your point being, I mean, she's literally right. It's exactly what they've become. This is, you know, Yahoo just took this from the New York Times, but it says it's made her a case study in the collapse of the old Republican establishment and its willing absorption into the new Trump-dominated one. Yeah, they say her climb to MAGA stardom may also be a cautionary tale. Really? Folks, this is what we are still dealing with. Now, forget all the other stuff. We're dealing with a media that is shameless in its partisanship. Also from Yahoo, we get what almost might be called a dose of sanity from District of Columbia Mayor Muriel Bowser. Now, this one Yahoo took from ABC News. So this is going to sound weird at first, but when you think about it, so she's calling on the president, the installed president, Dopey Joe, to either end work-from-home telework policies for federal employees or turn over vacant government buildings in the nation's capital for housing in a new push to move 100,000 new residents into the city. Now that part's messed up. But she's right here. The federal government accounts for one-third of properties owned or leased in Washington. Well, that's us, folks. That's us. Property doesn't belong to Congress. It doesn't belong to the Senate. It doesn't belong to the executive or judiciary. It belongs to us. Now, it says the city is utilizing tax breaks to encourage the conversion of vacant office buildings as a solution to the lack of housing. But Bowser says Dopey Joe needs to help. Now, what she's saying is either get rid of the work-from-home telework practices of the federal government, and I don't disagree with that, offload that property and let the District of Columbia use it. Or she even goes to say, by businesses or by any other user willing to revitalize it. She says right now 25,000 people currently call D.C. home, but the city will add 15,000 residents over the next 5 years and 87,000 more before it's all said and done. 87,000. Would that be the IRS agents? Now, it says currently 92% of the central business district consists of commercial space. Residential only accounts for 8%. Now, think about this, though. The lion's share of government employees, and I'm not talking about interns or first-year, you know, paid staff. I'm talking about bureaucracy and establishment. Those folks live in the suburbs. There's a good reason for it. I mean, D.C.'s a great place to visit, but it's, you know, there are whole swaths of areas you don't dare go to after 5 p.m. But, you know, she's right. Why is this land sitting vacant or idle? Why isn't it being leased commercially? I'm not so much in favor of putting it in the hands of Muriel Bowser or the D.C. government management, but something other than letting it sit. Damn right. It's our property. And one, it takes up one third of the District of Columbia. Now on to something a tad more serious. Monday night, in a game between the host Cincinnati Bengals and the Buffalo Bills, Bills safety DeMar Hamlin suffered cardiac arrest after a play involving him and Bengals wide receiver T. Higgins. Hamlin got up after the play, then seconds later he collapsed to the field. Bills medical staff was out to him ASAP. He was administered care on the field, which involved CPR, oxygen, and the use of a defibrillator. They actually tried to remove him once and had to bring him back down to the field while they were moving because moving him was causing some kind of problem. The entire Bills team circled around Hamlin during his on-field care. You can see, when you watch it, you can see how crushed the Bills were. But Bengals players were equally affected. The Bills then huddled on the sideline, and then their defense returned to the field, as the Bengals offense did. This was on a special teams play, I believe. But in what can only be called an extremely selfish, caring, and mature move, Bengals head coach Zach Taylor went over to Bills head coach Sean McDermott, and the two met with game officials and agreed to pause the game. Now, some people were mad that the NFL didn't postpone it right away, but evidently the NFL brass and the Players Association leadership eventually concurred. They ultimately postponed the game. No makeup or return to the game has been settled, and right now nobody should be worried about that, frankly. It would have been both impossible and heartless to continue the game. And thankfully, everyone involved understood that. The players from each team that returned to the field to continue the game had to have been relieved. I mean, thank God for the two head coaches and officials, and by extension, eventually, the league and the players' union. But there's no way after something like that, you know, that you can – and we'll talk about the Bears in a second. As TV analysts, separate, not together, but on separate programs, Ryan Clark and Booger McFarland noted in a separate – studio shows on air, this isn't about football. It's not about a game. It's not about the standings or the playoff. It's about DeMar Hamlin. Now, there's been some better news, but right now, still, he needs our prayers. His family needs our prayers. His teammates and the team staff and the coaches need our prayers, as well as the Bengals organization. The fans in attendance need our prayers. I mean, this was a heartbreaking and frightening ordeal for anyone who witnessed it. I pray to God for this young man's recovery. Look, just his recovery, whether he's able to return to the field or not, who cares at this point? Like, social media posts, and of course folks have been pulling them up like crazy, indicate he's a caring, thoughtful, and giving young man. Football is but a part of his life, but it doesn't define him. He did set up a foundation called Chasing M's and a GoFundMe page to raise funds for toy drives, with a goal, a very modest goal, of $2,500. As of early Tuesday, the amount donated was over $3 million. As of this morning, it's over $6 million. Now, thanks in part to some healthy contributions from athletes, NFL owners, some broadcasters and reporters like Aaron Andrews, two names I enjoyed seeing, by the way, were former Hawkeye and current San Francisco 49ers tight end George Kittle and pro wrestler Chris Jericho. Kudos. Kudos to them and to the American public for responding and honoring DeMar Hamlin. As of Tuesday morning, he was sedated and in critical condition at University of Cincinnati Medical Center. So God be with the medical staff taking care of him. God be with DeMar Hamlin and his family. And thank God, people immediately realized this wasn't about a sport, which, after all, is a form of entertainment, and instead realized that this is about a 24-year-old young man who's already had an impact on the world. And may he recover and continue to have an impact on our world. Now, a statement from his family yesterday basically said he is improving. As of today, according to family and to some people in the Bills organization, DeMar Hamlin is starting to show signs of improvement. Thank God for that, at least. Supposedly he was needing 100% assistance breathing, now only 50%. You know, that's a move in the right direction. Now, another interesting side note to this came in a tweet from a tweeter named Avi K, A-V-I and then K. It said this: pretty crazy how fast praying in public at a football game became okay again. There is truth to that. Now, I don't think he or she was saying you know, this is bad, but it's amazing how, you know, like that, it was okay to pray again on the field. Yeah, this is, it's just scary. The reason I mentioned the Bears, Bears were playing the Detroit Lions in 1971. And late in the game, Lions had a receiver named Chuck Hughes. Now, some people said back then it was a Butkus hit. It wasn't. He wasn't even part of the play. He came running back toward the huddle and grabbed his chest and collapsed. Ed Obradovich of the Bears at the time admitted, said later he's horrified by his emotional thought that he was faking it because they had no timeouts. So he yelled at him. But then he saw Dick Butkus go over there and wave frantically to the Lions sideline. Now, they were not able to revive Chuck Hughes. He was only 28 years old. Turned out he had arteriosclerosis in his in and around his heart. And so it was the kind of thing wasn't back then, wasn't caught in, you know, physicals like that. Very sad, but it, for those that remember that, it was horrifying at the time to think that here's a game that people are just playing for enjoyment and watching for enjoyment, and this happens. It's very sad. And thankfully, right now, DeMar Hamlin is okay. Meanwhile, back in the GOP side of the House, several GOP lawmakers are claiming that presumed Speaker Kevin McCarthy has, quote, his opportunity to win the speakership, unquote. Now, among the complaints are McCarthy being vague on several previous GOP talking points or bullet points, policies which include a mandated balanced budget, replacing national income, payroll, and estate taxes with a national sales tax, approving a plan from Texas House Republicans to address the surge in migration at the southern border, and pushing for term limits for members of Congress. Other plans, which include forming a committee to target weaponized government and allowing a single Republican to make a motion to vacate the chair and force a vote to oust the speaker, have only been met with compromise from McCarthy. Now, currently, the House sits with 222 GOP members. In order to win the speakership, McCarthy needs 218 votes. Thus, he can only afford four defections from his Republican cohorts. And my guess is he's not getting any votes from the Democrat side. In short, this could get very interesting when the next subsequent votes to bounce Vava Vodka Nancy Pelosi from the speakership conducted. Now, they're going into their sixth vote as of now. But here's where it gets interesting. Yesterday, there were three votes, none of which got him the speakership. More interesting, AOC was spotted on the House floor speaking with Florida Representative Matt Gaetz and Arizona Republican Paul Gozar. I guess it's Gates or Gaetz. Both of them are Republicans. Apparently, now remember, this is according to AOC, but apparently both said McCarthy had convinced enough Dems to leave the chamber to lower the necessary vote threshold, and that she told both of them it was not true. She said McCarthy would not be getting any kind of help from the Dems. Most interesting, though, the third vote went worse for McCarthy than the previous votes. In other words, he's losing Republicans all the time. Now, President Trump has come out in support of Kevin McCarthy, and he's implored the GOP to unite and get going on the agenda they promised the American people leading up to the midterm elections. As Hawkeye Mike noted to me in a text this morning, if the GOP continues to splinter, we could end up seeing a Dem in the speakership. How incredibly boneheaded would that be from the Republican Party? Believe it or not, at least one moderate Republican has said there are preliminary discussions with Dems to elect a consensus candidate for speaker. This is complete idiocy, insanity, and I am afraid now typical GOP leadership these days. How in hell can the GOP be thinking this? Why haven't he heard any of the names of these congressmen? Although I guess one look at the roll call vote will tell us who he, she, they, is, are. And here's the other thing. We have news that a fifth vote has failed, but another possibility exists, that there is a retired Republican representative. The speaker does not have to be a sitting member of Congress, FYI. This a retired Republican rep is possibly on the table as that unity candidate. Fred Upton of Michigan, Fred Upchuck, indicated possible interest. Oh, yeah, he voted to impeach President Trump. What the actual hell? Together? Can you not just get the Speaker of the House elected? It's just pitiful. Absolutely pitiful. This little ditty, it's a commentary from American Liberty News, had a little fun with the recent cold snap, except it doesn't really read as all that much fun. Here goes. From AmericanLibertyNews.com. And, come on, don't do this to me. It's telling me it's invalid. Oh, now it's redirecting me. So basically, I'll try and summarize. This talks about why electric vehicles are not yet the future. Talks about utilities were asking people to unplug unnecessary or unused appliances or gadgets. In other words, if you're not charging your phone, don't have your phone charger sitting plugged in. If you're not using a fan or a portable heater or air conditioner, don't leave it plugged in. Duke Energy said this to their customers. If it doesn't interfere with health or safety, lower your thermostat. Manage your water heater setting. Set your water heater to 120 degrees or less. Please try to limit the use of your washer, dryer, and dishwasher. However, if you must use these appliances, run full loads of laundry and dishes. It's important to run full loads to take advantage of the hot water already being used. By God, appliance companies are already telling you now that you don't need to run full loads. It says unplug standing appliances. Any appliances you leave plugged in, phone chargers, razors, coffee makers, that kind of thing. Turn off lights when you leave the room. Fans of electric vehicles say right now that the grid can handle the current crop. I don't think so. So I had I'm out paddling the other night, and I had somebody who works for a major Ford dealership as their service advisor. And I asked her, you know, I've had Fred Akins on before. Fred, you know, is a fan of electric cars or the concept of them. But she said, look, it's just not here yet. Technology is just not refined enough. You've just got to take that into account. She says, hybrids, there are some issues, but, you know, it's at least safer. At least you've got the backup of a gas engine. And as somebody said, she said, there's a lot more bigger problems to solve coming along with electric vehicles. But, yeah, we're talking about, you know, rolling brownouts type of deal like they do in the summer, which a lot of people cannot, you know, be doing if they live someplace where it's 10 below. So, yeah, you know, people don't deny this, but I agree. If we were all electric and suddenly we all plugged into the existing power grid, I'm afraid, yeah, that's going to be problems. Here's another story from American Liberty News. It's about House members Jim Jordan of Ohio and Mike Johnson of Louisiana. They've sent communication to FBI Director Chris Wray demanding all documents and communications between the FBI and Twitter from 1-1 of 2020 to present, most of which concerns the FBI's efforts to suppress any negative items that would affect Dopey Joe's campaign for president. And the letter reads thusly. I'm just going to read the letter. I'm not going to read the whole article, but it's not a bad letter from these guys. It says, we are investigating politicization and abuses at the Federal Bureau of Investigation, as well as big tech's censorship of conservatives online. Newly released information shows the FBI has coordinated extensively with Twitter to censor or otherwise affect content on Twitter's platform. These documents show that the FBI maintained this relationship with Twitter apart from any particularized need for a specific investigation. but as a permanent and ongoing surveillance operation. These revelations sadly reinforce our deep concerns about the FBI's misconduct and its hostility to the First Amendment. From disclosed Twitter documents and publicly available information, it is clear the FBI worked extensively with Twitter to advance censorship of certain speech on Twitter's platform. Twitter's internal documents reflect a cozy relationship between the FBI and Twitter. Numerous former FBI employees have taken jobs at Twitter, which one journalist described as a unique one big happy family vibe. This closeness created, in the words of journalist Matt Taibbi, a master canine quality of the FBI's relationship to Twitter. For example, Twitter employees maintained regular check-ins with the FBI as they decided how to censor certain content. These communications occurred before the 2020 and 2022 elections. And at least one prominent FBI official expects that these censorship operations will continue in advance of the 2024 elections. It's just, there's more to the letter. And I'm just not going to get all the way into it. But it's basically they're wanting all. Oh, here's what they want. Here's the titles. They want the names and titles of all FBI employees or contractors who may have communicated with any employee, contractor, agent, or representative of Twitter about content or users. All documents and communications between or among any FBI employees or contractors and any employee, contractor, agent, or representative of Twitter, including but not limited to the following individuals. Among them, Jack Dorsey, James Baker, plus a few of the other Twitterati types. This is, I mean, you think about this. Welcome, by the way, T. Bodie, and to the chat room. Indy Hawk has been in the whole time. T. Bodie is back. Sue is listening on the phone lines as well. I should remember to mention that to you guys in a second. But yeah, so we're literally, first of all, why is Christopher Wray still the director of the FBI? That I don't know. In addition to this, a federal judge in the Western District of Louisiana, Terry Dowdy, has ordered the La Dope Nostra to turn over all documents and communications between the federal government and big tech companies. It's part of a suit brought by the attorneys general of Louisiana and Missouri, respectively. So, yeah, this could get really interesting. If the GOP can get their crap together, put a good person in the speaker chair, hold feet to the fire, we may start seeing some actual positive changes in D.C., but until then. Anyway, yeah, I didn't even mention before, several ways to interact with the show. T. Bodie and Indy Hawk are exhibiting one way where they came in through the website, but then came to the chat function, the chat room, and they've logged in and they're chatting. Or you can call and listen in. And you can just listen. You don't have to talk, but you can listen. If you want to talk, what you do is you hit the one on your phone. But this is the number, 319-527-6706. If you got something to say, call in, hit the one. I get this little hand-raised icon. Very cool. So I should have remembered that. And, of course, you can always reach out, email hjpsports1980@gmail.com or at hpolysports over there on Twitter. So the Epoch Times has done a follow-up story on Robert Lavoy Finicum. He's the Arizona rancher who was killed in Oregon, shot in the back by law enforcement officers on his way to meet with a sheriff. He was presenting Finicum at a speaking engagement on property rights and standing up to government to protect those rights. His family is now turning to the Supreme Court 7 years later to get some sense of resolution and closure. Now, Lavoy Finicum had been a part of the 41-day protest and standoff at the Bundy Ranch near the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge in Oregon. Oregon police and federal officials have been slow to clarify the circumstances of the shooting, the reasons for it, and the discrepancy between their statements and what was captured on video during the two successive confrontations that occurred when law enforcement officers were conducting what they called routine felony stops. And they said they were conducting routine. So Lavoy Finicum was on his way to this presentation, and they had set up a roadblock. And they said it was a routine felony stop. Here's the problem. As one of their lawyers representing the family says, there's no such thing as a routine felony stop. None. There's no such thing. There was no warrant. unmarked SUVs operated by Oregon State Police SWAT and an FBI hostage rescue team prepared roadblocks while an FBI aircraft hovered overhead shooting video. Finnecombe's pickup, the people that pick up with Lavoie Finnecombe were also recording video. They didn't like, obviously, the fact that people were starting to listen to Lavoie Finnecombe and others. He was not at Malheur when he encountered law enforcement, though. The roadblock was an hour away. He was driving the first vehicle. He stopped. State police pointed pointed guns with red laser sights at him. He said he was going over to meet the sheriff in Grant County. He said, "You can come along with us, and we can talk about this over there. You can go ahead and shoot me. Put the laser right there. Put the bullet through the head. Okay, boys? It's going to get real. You want my blood on your hands? Get it done, because we've got people to see and places to go." There was no arrest warrant and no probable cause to arrest. They just claimed they were doing a routine felony stop. Under the Fourth Amendment, which is the right of people to be secure from unreasonable search and seizure, including seizure of a person, there is no such thing in the law as a felony stop. Now, unfortunately, Hawkeye Mike couldn't be here today because I would discuss this part with him. The lawyer says they need probable cause to believe a particular crime is committed by a particular person. He left the first roadblock. He went around a curve, and there was another roadblock waiting. He tried to drive around it, got stuck in the snow on the side of the road. Shortly after, he got out of the vehicle, walked through deep snow with his hands up. The next part of the video is a matter of controversy. His hands apparently went down, and instantly he was shot in the back and fell to the ground. It's unclear why his hands went down. He may have been trying to balance his steps in the deep snow or motion to police. Law enforcement says they were going for a gun they found in his pocket. But friends and family say he always kept his gun in a holster unless he was driving. Then it was kept under a blanket on the dashboard. His wife, Jeanette Finnecombe, believes the gun could have been planted on him after the shooting. So, yeah, that's not too cool at all. So Oregon State Police, of course, is saying it's always a tragedy when a life is lost, regardless of the circumstances, blah, blah, blah. Epic Times itself has requested comment from Bureau of Land Management, U.S. Department of Justice, Oregon State Police, the Chute County Major Incident Team, and the Harney County District Attorney's Office. But as they pointed out, they're going to the Supreme Court because they've filed suit against other agencies. And, yeah, as it says, it's pretty hard to prosecute the government in its own court. So, yeah, not good. Not good. So hopefully there's some resolution from this sooner rather than later. You know, it's always, I mean, this kind of thing, we've had these other standoffs before. Randy Weaver at Ruby Ridge lost his family. He eventually passed away. You know, Waco. And look, I'm not a fan of the Branch Davidians, but what happened at Waco was absolutely wrong. So, yeah, routine felony stops. The January 6th Inquisition has withdrawn its subpoena of President Trump. Now, much as it's filled with double talk, their subpoena, President Trump's response is damn near gold. Basically, he was subpoenaed by the committee in October for testimony and documents regarding the protests at the Capitol January 6, 2021. Said, in light of the imminent end of our investigation, the select committee can no longer pursue the specific information covered by the subpoena. So therefore, through this letter, I hereby formally withdraw the subpoena issued to former President Trump and notify you that he is no longer obligated to comply or produce records in response to said subpoena. Here's what Trump put on social media. Was just advised that the unselect committee of political thugs has withdrawn the subpoena of me concerning the January 6th protest of the crooked 2020 presidential election. They probably did so because they knew I did nothing wrong, or they were about to lose in court. Perhaps the FBI's involvement in rigging the election played into their decision. In any event, the subpoena is dead. Oh, love it when he gets rolling. Meanwhile, the installed president, Dopey Joe, you're going to love this. He's doing what he does best, hypocrisy. He demands China travelers provide negative COVID tests after calling Trump's 2020 COVID response nakedly xenophobic. That's right. He's now going to require travelers from China to show a negative coronavirus test to enter the United States. Remember what he said in 2020? He said former President Trump's coronavirus response was, quote, fanning the flames, unquote, of, quote, hate, fear, and xenophobia against Asian Americans. Starting tomorrow, travelers from China by air will have to provide a negative COVID-19 test to enter the nation within 2 days of their departure from airports in mainland China, Hong Kong, and Macau. Biden called the Trump restrictions in May of 2020 denials, delays, and distractions, many of which were nakedly xenophobic. The pandemic has unleashed familiar forces of hate, fear, and xenophobia that he always flames and have always existed in this society. Later said Trump, of course, is a racist, saying, we've always had racists, but Trump's the first racist to actually make it to being president. So now, he is requiring Chinese visitors to have a negative coronavirus test. You know what that sounds like to me? Wildly racist and nakedly xenophobic. God. And he's going to, you know what he's going to say? If he's actually going to say that we stopped another COVID outbreak because of this. He's actually going to say that. He's going to say, of course, he's going to stupidly say it, you know, like, Asians are the ones bringing it on. I mean, he's going to say something stupid like that, sort of like when he says, you know, black people are smart enough to vote, too. I mean, when he says that kind of crap, that's what he's going to do. Moving on, FTX founder Sam Bankman-Fried has pleaded not guilty to 8 charges in federal court alleging he cheated customers with his cryptocurrency exchange. Included among the charges are counts of wire fraud and conspiracy to commit money laundering. He could get up to 115 years. But I would guess he'll eventually plead that down or alternatively turn on others involved in the scam or scheme. Here's another thought. Maybe it was just bad management and stupidity. Dollars that went missing in the day or two before everything came to light. Then again, how does a supposed $32 billion entity crash overnight? Worse than that, how does a scam become worth $32 billion? I got some partial answers. Number one, it was never actually worth $32 billion. Number two, there is $32 billion worth of stupidity and gullibility out there. Or number three, it was never worth $32 billion. There is probably $10 billion worth of stupidity and gullibility, and the remainder of that $32 billion is made up of blind greed. Other interesting notes from this, the trial date is set for October 2nd. Yeah, 9 months from now. Bankman-Fried is out on $250 million bail, which is 25 times that required for Bernie Madoff. His parents have pledged their home as partial collateral. The most interesting thing, maybe, is that identities of two people who guaranteed the bulk of the $250 million bail are redacted. Here's part of what his counsel said about that. They said, there is serious cause for concern that the two additional sureties would face similar intrusions on their privacy, as well as threats and harassment if their names appear unredacted on their bonds or their identities are otherwise publicly disclosed. Aside from the fact that that's the world's longest run-on sentence and has zero, I mean, at least in the article that I saw, no punctuation. I hope that's not an attorney. I mean, I hope his brief was better than that. The judge ruled, by the way, the identities and their addresses can be redacted for now, but it may be revisited later. Now, the two guarantors had not signed on at the time, but are expected to do so by the January 5th deadline, which is tomorrow. There's another charge that I haven't seen mentioned, but I can't believe they haven't even thought about it or considered it. That is racketeering. I mean, I can't believe there's only one instance of most of these charges. Then again, Sam Bankman-Fried isn't an accused mobster, so maybe they only charge racketeering and mob cases. But guess what? Included under the RICO statute are wire fraud and mail fraud. So why is racketeering not included among the charges? Meanwhile, in the Just In Case You Forgot I Am a Has-Been department, the two principal actors in Franco Zeffirelli's 1968 film version of Romeo and Juliet are suing Paramount Pictures for child abuse to the tune of $500 million. The actors, Olivia Hussey and Leonard Whiting, claim they were assured by Zeffirelli, who had, by the way, died in 2019, that it would be tasteful and that they would have flesh-colored undergarments. At the time of filming, Olivia Hussey was 15 and Leonard Whiting was 16. Now, in the film, you get a shot of Whiting's bare butt. Who cares? It's probably not as gratuitous as the numerous shots of Rick Springfield's bare butt in the movie Hard to Hold. And then you also see Olivia Hussey's rather impressive breasts. I say impressive because, well, they were impressive. Okay, let's clarify. I was impressed. Actually, no, I wasn't, because I've never seen the movie. I just remember reading some review or article with someone saying that the film's best moment involved, quote, Olivia Hussey's impressive breasts. Trust me, if Lost Horizon is any indication, she wasn't ever going to be Oscar-bound. Hell, she isn't even bad enough to be Razzie-bound. Tell you about how mundane her acting chops really are. The saddest part of this, at least up until now, I actually did see the Rick Springfield movie Hard to Hold. I plead forgiveness, I do, and I hope to somehow recoup the two or so hours wasted on that occurrence. Anyway, neither has gone on to do much, if anything, since that film. Like I said, Olivia Hussey did appear in that 1973 musical remake of Lost Horizon, based on the James Hilton novel. It was actually done way better as a film by Frank Capra in 1937. And no, Olivia Hussey did keep her clothes on for this movie. Had she shed a couple items that might have done better, or at least gotten a couple positive reviews? Here's the worst part. It's a guilty pleasure for me. It still sucks in terms of, like, movie making. It's cheesy. And if you saw the film today and you found out that Peter Finch went on to win an Oscar, you'd be shocked. He won the Oscar for Network. Anyway, here's the story from Variety as it appeared on Yahoo. There is a nice little part at the end which will probably blow this whole thing out of the water. Raise your hands out there when you realize what that part is. So I'm going to skim through. They were just teenagers when they electrified audiences in 1968. Now they're in their 70s and they filed a lawsuit, blah, 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 accusing Paramount of sexually exploiting them and distributing nude images of adolescent children. Said he, the director allegedly implored them to perform in the nude with body makeup or the picture would fail. The suit also alleges that he was being dishonest and that Whiting and Hussey were in fact filmed nude without their knowledge. How could they not have been? What they were told and what went on were two different things, said Tony Marinazzi, who's a business manager for both actors. They trusted Franco. At 16, as actors, they took his lead that he would not violate that trust they had. Frankly, at 16, what do they do? There are no options. There was no hashtag me too. Whiting and Hussey have suffered mental anguish and emotional distress in the 55 years since the film's release and have also lost out on job opportunities. So this lawsuit relies in part on a California law that temporarily suspended the statute of limited limitations on older claims of child sexual abuse. It was when you saw the influx of complaints against the Boy Scouts of the Catholic Church. And this deadline ended 31st of December. Here's the thing, though. In 2018, Variety magazine, Olivia Hussey did an interview. She defended the nude scene. Here's what she said. Nobody my age had done that before. Adding that Zeffirelli shot it tastefully. It was needed for the film. In another interview in 2018 with Fox News, she said the scene was taboo in America, but nudity was already common in European films at that time. It wasn't that big of a deal, she said, and Leonard wasn't shy at all. In the middle of shooting, I just completely forgot I didn't have clothes on. Yeah, somehow I have a feeling that Paramount's legal team might just throw that one in there. Unbelievable. Suing for $500 million. Another little tidbit as it relates to aspiring House Speaker Kevin McCarthy. Last week, he promised to reopen the Capitol, which the Dems have shrouded in secretive fortress-like quote-unquote protection since the events of January 6, 2021. Currently, Americans can only enter the Capitol at limited times by appointment only. McCarthy says the GOP wants to restore the Capitol to those whom it rightfully belongs, the American people. Now, not surprisingly, Big Left, mainly through big media and snarky social media users, decry the possible reopening. Some have gone so far as to say that McCarthy and the GOP, quote, support insurrectionists and liars, unquote. It's kind of interesting, given that it was the Democrat Speaker of the House who ultimately dismissed the idea of additional security at the Capitol that day. It's the double-edged sword that Big Left constantly skewers its own twisted sense of logic. I mean, they've got to protect corrupt lawmakers and bureaucrats from the people they wish to control, i.e. the American public. Seriously, though. Seriously, they want to protect themselves from people who are calling out and demanding accountability for their greed, for their corruption, for their system of patronage, for their incompetence. Unless anyone has forgotten, the Capitol belongs to all Americans. I don't care, conservative, liberal, Democrat, Republican, all Americans, all faiths, all beliefs, all backgrounds. So that the fact that a certain segment of our population, and indeed our government, want to keep it closed off is unacceptable. Sorry, it's unacceptable. Now, remember when I said I was going to start holding feet to the fire? It started with my own congressman. Well, we're two weeks into it. I still not received any reply on Twitter. I still not been able to find any phone number for his office or campaign. But again, hold feet to the fire. Contact your congressperson. Tell them the Capitol should be reopened. Here's some good news. An Illinois judge has declared that state's cashless bail law unconstitutional. Among the elements cited were the legislature was stripping the judiciary of some of its powers and authority under criminal law, that the legislature improperly acted to amend the Constitution, that the matter should have been brought before voters, and most importantly, it may cause an inability to guarantee a defendant's appearance in court. Gee, who knew? And there are far fine people in Illinois. Chicago's a great city to visit. But beyond that, the state has gone off the rails. Cashless bail was just the latest attempt to pretend appeasing the masses. But instead, as this judge noted, it would have been an added carte blanche to criminals. Another internet laughy. The first half, or it's the Babylon Bee's predictions for 2023, in the first half of 2023. January 1st, millions set out to read the entire Bible. January 4th, dozens are still reading their entire Bible. January 6th, AOC dies again of PTSD after recounting her death of January 6th. February 13th, Kamala Harris reports that Biden had an unfortunate accident coming down the stairs. February 16th, Kamala Harris caught laughing while at Biden's funeral. February 19th, Kamala Harris sworn in. February 20th, weed heavily criminalized in all 50 states. March 3rd, Whoopi Goldberg says something racist. March 13th, AOC says something stupid. March 23rd, John Fetterman finally finishes taking his oath of office. Oh, my God. Oh, cold but true. April 4th, the war in Ukraine ends. April 5th, the war in Taiwan begins. Sam Bankman-Fried says another 50 million of people's money has gone missing. May 1st, Obama releases a new memoir. May 12th, no one shows up to work across America. Also, all Nintendo Switches are sold out for some reason. May 19th, Webster changes the definition of gender. May 22nd, Bob Iger, reinstalled Disney CEO, bends the knee and swears fealty to Ron DeSantis. May 25th, public schools announce they will now allow Tuttle Twins books in school libraries. May 26th, Tuttle Twins books pulled from libraries after students start questioning teachers' biases. Oh, my God, these are good. June 4th, Kanye West says he's not crazy anymore. June 5th, Kanye West joins the KKK. Oh, that's some good stuff for the first half of 2023. In the meantime, though, it's time for a break. When we come back, we're going to talk some sports. Histrionic Mike, not Hawkeye Mike, but Histrionic Mike, who was on last week, he'll be back around 6:45. We're going to talk some sports and stuff, mainly Hawkeye stuff. But in the meantime, enjoy this break, and then we will be back. But you know what? What do we want to play? We want to play something good. I don't want to play anything bad. I want to play something good. I got just the thing. Be back in about 3 and a half.
Let me begin. I came to win.
And we are back on Hank Jones Poly Sports, Wednesday, January 4th, 2023. That was the House of Pain song, Jump Around. Now, of course, it's featured heavily in the movie, or prominently in the movie, Mrs. Doubtfire. That's where Robin Williams' character's wife, played by Sally Field, comes home, sees them having a party that wasn't supposed to be taking place. They're playing that song. She kicks them out. There's another reason I played it. T. Bodie sent a text today mentioning that Iowa is getting another quarterback in the transfer portal who happens to be transferring in from Wisconsin. That is their song. They play that at the end of their third quarter, just like Iowa has the wave at the end of the first quarter. Wisconsin has the jump around. Now, this year when Iowa beat Wisconsin, after the game, they played the jump around, believe it or not, sort of troll the Badger faithful and team. But so I figured I'd play. Hey, we got a new quarterback. Now, that's because we had a guy leave, another quarterback leaving the transfer portal, and I'll talk about that later with Histrionic Mike when he's on it. He's going to come in about 6:45. Again, this is Hank Jones with Hank Jones Poly Sports. The number to reach us, if you want to call, is 319-527-6706. You can just listen that way, but if you want to talk, hit the one on your phone, and I get a little hand raise icon. You can always reach out to me on Twitter, of course, at HPolySports, or you can, of course, email me, hjpsports80@gmail.com. And, of course, don't forget the other shows here on Global Patriot Radio every day, 7 days a week, 7 shows a week. Good stuff. Let's get to another laughy. This is the second half of the Babylon Bee's predictions. Starting in July, July 4th, Zelensky named President of the United States. August 8th, Dr. Fauci comes out of retirement after another COVID strain leaks from a lab. August 12th, Alex Jones sued for another $400 trillion. September 5th, Obama releases new memoir, which he also did on May 1st. That's classic. September 20th, Elon releases part 3,285 of the Twitter files. It is funny. He's just dropping these things. I can't decide if he's – I mean, it's funny because it's – we're seeing – Twitter's being exposed. He's exposing his own company. It's priceless. Now, October 27th, Elon Musk buys The View, promptly cancels the show forever. October 29th, U.S. Postal Service releases January 6th commemorative stamp. November 9th, Pizzagate conspiracy confirmed true. Number 23, CNN's Brian Stelter retires to Idaho to be with his kind. Elon Musk, and this is November 25th, Elon Musk announces gas-powered Tesla to save us all from the coming ice age. Oh, God. Literally, I have lived through the coming ice age, global warming, climate change. We're reverting to gas-powered Teslas, if you believe the predictions of Babylon Bee. December 5th, Disney announces Phase 5 of the Marvel Universe will be Brie Larson giving a series of two-hour TED Talks on misogyny. December 10th, a late-night host says something funny, and then in parentheses says, hey, we can dream, can't we? December 31st, the last remaining person still reading through their Bible finally finishes it. And there are your predictions from the Babylon Bee for 2023. So before Hawkeye or Histrionic Mike jumps in, we'll go through some college basketball stuff. In Hawkeye basketball, forward Patrick McCaffrey, now he is the son of head coach Fran McCaffrey, announced that he is taking a leave from the team to deal with anxiety issues. He said it's not related to his bout with cancer several years ago. For those of you who don't know or don't remember, Patrick McCaffrey at the age of, I believe, 14, was diagnosed with, I believe, thyroid cancer. And it was, I don't want to say touch and go, but it was a scary time for the McCaffrey family and for the team. By the way, the team has not looked good since losing to Eastern Illinois, where we were a 31.5-point favorite. We've dropped games to Nebraska and Penn State, both on the road. We host 15th-ranked Indiana tomorrow night. So, yeah, I'm not real confident. We might not even make the NIT this year. I would have said that 3 weeks ago. We might be NIT bound. Now I'm not really believing that even. Elsewhere, college basketball number to UConn got their first loss last weekend. Fell to number 22 Xavier, which has former Hawkeye Jack Nungy on their team. Number one Purdue held it through the weekend and are revoted number one again, and then they probably lose to Rutgers on Monday night. Then number 21 New Mexico goes down to Fresno State last night, so there are no undefeated teams left in Division I basketball. Now, on the other hand, I am not sure that even matters. Why? An NCAA committee has suggested an increase in participation for championship events, which could lead to roughly 90 or so teams in March Madness. So a couple of years from now, you might see losing teams in the NIT, or you might see the NIT go away, or they'll fold it in as part of March Madness, maybe, like a loser's bracket type deal. For the record, if football expanded, it would mean a 32-team playoff. Just so you know, 32 teams in their play. You know what? As long as it utilized the bowl system and cut down on the number of overall bowls, I'd be okay with that. You know, yeah, sure, why not? I mean, I'm under no illusion that a number 32 would beat a number one. But, yeah, I could believe in a two 16-team bracket, or even four 18 brackets. I could see, a number five beating a number four, a number six beating a number three in football. Now, in basketball, it's a little different. You've seen 16 seeds win once. But you've seen 15 seeds win. It's just a different animal. There's five guys on the court, not 11. Depth is crucial, but not like it is in football, believe it or not. Yeah, I'm not so sure a 90-team March Madness is all that appealing, but again, they'd have to figure out a way. I mean, compared to 68, I guess, yeah. But the next evenly spaced bracket would be 128 teams. So, yeah, I'm not seeing that. But maybe. You never know. I mean, they could do the first rounds through the first two weekends, something like that. That would be a way to do it. Moving on. I'm going to recap these, and then I'm going to bring in Mike. Tennessee dominated Clemson in the Orange Bowl. 31-14 with their backup quarterback. Also, Clemson was on their backup quarterback. Their starter, who was sort of relegated to, he was pulled in the ACC championship, I believe. He's entered the transfer portal, DJ Uiagalelei. After an early lead, Kansas State got blown out by Alabama in the Sugar Bowl. By the way, Bama quarterback Bryce Young, among other Tide players, and it's declared for the draft. Really interesting game in the Cotton Bowl. Tulane came back, scored 16 points in the final 4-plus minutes to beat USC. I mean, a month plus, gosh, not even a full month ago, people were thinking USC was a playoff team. PSU, Penn State, pretty much dominated Utah in the Rose Bowl. The other thing they proved, they were head and shoulders above the rest of the Big Ten, but not above Ohio State and Michigan, so this year, again, it was the Big 2 plus 12, I guess you'd say. Question, as we get to the CFP playoff games, was Michigan robbed on that long pass that appeared to go for a touchdown against TCU? Remember the next play, they lost two plays later, I think, they lost a fumble, lost a scoring opportunity. They lost by 6 points. And was Ohio State robbed on a non-targeting call that took Marvin Harrison Jr. out of the game against Georgia. Ryan Day said he believes the loss of Harrison made a difference in the game. Now, Ohio State still had a chance to win. Had a final play field goal, 50-yard. It went wide left, but, you know, again, it's does it take a top Georgia player out of the game for targeting and keep Marvin Harrison in the game? It's a good question. Now, special mention, I've only been talking about New Year's Six Bowls. Purdue and LSU in the Citrus Bowl.
Wow.
I'm pretty sure Florida Citrus Sports wasn't liking it. Last Friday, I was out on a paddle, believe it or not. Or no, Sunday. I was on a paddle with downtown Orlando with a mother and daughter, and then opposite them, a father and son. The father and son were down for the Citrus Bowl to watch LSU. The mother and her daughter were down to watch Purdue. Now, interestingly enough, her son is a backup running back on Purdue's team. She says he doesn't really play at all, not really even on special teams. But Purdue, I mean, they lost several players, key players, who opted out. Now, she told me some interesting things. One, with Jeff Brohm leaving and a couple of his assistants, the players aren't really all that upset. Now, he left by text. Not really. He sort of said, you know, they sent a text saying mandatory meeting, but then word got out that he was going to Louisville, Jeff Brohm. Now, this guy said he doesn't tamper or anything, but as this woman said, he was on texting with players, trying to get players to go with him to Louisville, players who had not entered the transfer portal. So think about that. Mr. I don't tamper, we didn't tamper, was trying to get existing Purdue players to leave with him to go to Louisville, players who had not entered the transfer portal. So no, they're not all that unhappy that he's gone. They really aren't. So I'm going to bring in Mike, not Hawkeye Mike, but Avid Histrionic Mike, to talk about the Hawkeyes. Mike, you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
How you doing? It was a good experience watching that game last Saturday. Good experience watching that game.
Yeah, I mean, it was what we were used to this year. You know, defense scores more than the offense. So.
Yeah, but you know what? You can't blame. I mean, I think once you're up 21-0, everybody's saying, "Why did we do this? Why did we do that?" There was no reason to. You know, you don't do that to a first-time quarterback.
Exactly. I mean, and they did. They tried a little more in that fourth quarter, that last 5 minutes, with a couple of those passes, and then where they got to Reganey, and then they got that deep one to Lachey. It was just past his fingertips. I mean, they still tried to do stuff. They were not trying to put him in bad situations to, you know.
Exactly.
I don't think there was going to be a comeback happening, but I just think they were just trying to, you know, bring him along slowly because it was such a limited playbook.
Yeah, exactly. And then, of course, we get the news that Carson May, Joey Labus's backup, has entered the transfer portal. Not a shock.
No.
You know. So who was your player of the game? Well, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, for the player, you know, the player of the game for me is going to be, you know, we can talk about Xavier Wampa's interception return and how well he played in his first start. And Cooper, I mean, come on. Coop's.
Yeah.
Again, he's the face of the team moving forward for the next, hopefully, year, maybe, you know, at least a year. But for me, it was Sebastian Castro because of what from the minute that the first offensive play for Kentucky, he batted down that pass when he got in the backfield. And from then on, he had a lot of good hits. And that one deep pass that Kentucky, if it would have been on the mark or he wouldn't have gotten his hand up, that was going to be a completion and could have changed the whole outlook. So for me, it was Sebastian Castro.
Yeah, I'd still go with Jack Campbell or Torrey Taylor. I mean, Taylor was just so on with his punts, but Campbell's just
seven
he just brings
five
a
of them inside the 20.
Yeah, he just brings a total. Campbell just brings a total, you know, attitude with him to the team. I just think that was you know we mentioned I thought it was really nice that Dallas Kratiff actually played in the game despite the fact he's in the portal. Mm-hmm. I think that shows that there's a right way and a wrong way to enter the portal. I think it shows a lot of class on his part. And I think it shows a lot of class on Kirk Ferentz's part to let him play. So, you know, you know, Cooper's influence, though, I mean, his doubting punts, I mean, he's just all over the field. I mean, I just would really hope that he's there for his entire eligibility, whether he's there 4 years or not. I just hope he doesn't transfer to a Big Ten team or anything like that. So what's your thoughts on, go ahead, sorry.
I was going to say, I just hope they maybe try to incorporate a little bit of offense with him. I mean, he's such a dynamic. If you ever got a chance to see his tape from when he was in high school, I mean, he's a dynamic offensive player too, even more than defense. So I would love to just see just some once in a while, you know, even some Wildcat style stuff, you know, just to keep people on their toes, you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, are you surprised that Carson May entered the portal?
I was surprised just because he's a redshirt freshman essentially this year. I mean, this is his redshirt year. So I figured he'd want to stick around. But with Cade McNamara having 2 years, I don't know if he'll take both. You have Marco Linez coming in, I think.
Yeah.
And then Joey Labus playing the entire game, and he was supposed to play some. Carson May was.
Yeah.
There's rumors of it. So
right.
It does and it doesn't. Just in this day and age, and you and I had talked about it a little bit, this is just the new norm. You know, if you don't get playing time or you don't see playing time, you're going to leave. So.
Yeah. Well, of course, I think it might have been prompted by news we just got that former Wisconsin quarterback Deacon Hill is coming to Iowa. So I don't know if that was in response to Carson May or if that was what precipitated Carson May's decision. I don't know. Is there any more news on Lucas Van?
He's gone. He has declared as of yesterday.
He has declared Lucas Van Ness. So Lucas Van Ness is going pro.
Yeah. And ESPN had is it Field? I think it is. Did his top 20, his top, you know, his first round mock, and he had Van Ness going in the first round, like 27-28.
Really?
Right in there. So I mean, yeah, There's been since mid-season, early season, there's been people having him as being a mid, you know, low first-round pick. So, and that's anywhere from like 17 to 27.
Yeah, but then you got to go. I think there's no point in staying really for him. So, as we turn to 2023, you know, we got another good commitment, wide receiver Seth Anderson.
Yep.
And Luke Lachey, of course, emerged this season. So, although Sam Laporta is leaving, at least you know that Luke Lachey is there, and of course Eric All coming in. Do you think with Nico Rogini staying? By the way, he had that was an awesome catch he had
near
the
end.
You know. Amazing catch. I wish we'd see that more this year. But, I mean, do you have hope for the pass game next year?
I do. But we talked about this a little bit watching the game. It's like it really comes down to that offensive line. Nothing they could – I mean, it was two steps and anybody was getting hit back there. So I think if we can get some mediocre play, not poor play like we've had, or even just above average, we would be fine in, you know, throwing the ball.
Yeah, what are the guys
in
the chat room?
I don't think we're done in the portal either. I'm sorry?
Oh, I don't think so either. The portal's actually – it ends like January 15th or something. I didn't realize that
yeah,
it's actually –
it's heating up. There's a lot of people that have announced just in the last day or so.
Yeah. One of the chatters in here, T. Bodie, who's come on the show many times and one of my roommates in college one summer, he made the point, though, you know it's great. We got a transfer portal guy, but why aren't we getting more offensive linemen in the portal? I can't believe we're not looking for offensive linemen. I can't believe
that we are.
You know,
we just got an official visit set up for Walter Roos from Stanford.
Okay,
39 starts. He'll be here Friday, I think it is. But it's us, Auburn, I think. Kansas or Kansas State or somebody like that is his top four right now. So, I mean, it's going to be I hate to say it, but a bidding war for him. So,
any news? I haven't seen in the last day or two, any news on, like, I haven't seen anything is Terry Roberts found a place yet or no?
No, Neither has Arlen Bruce. I was actually looking at Arlen's Twitter account today, and he's been like super Hawkeye fan during the game. He was like cheering on Coop, you know, when he got the MVP and, you know, actually started following Seth Anderson. So I just, and yeah, with Terry Roberts, I haven't seen anything on either one of them. Last time I saw was Arland. I think he visited Arkansas, and that was before Christmas. So yeah. I haven't seen anything since.
I know Terry Roberts has been down on folks who are getting after Caden Proctor on Twitter, which I agree. I mean, that's just no reason to.
Yeah.
But so he just seems down on Iowa, though, in a lot of ways. I know some people tweeting to him and saying, you know, what the hell happened? You were so positive. All of a sudden you're all negative. What's gone on? You know, and he's not answered any of that. And he doesn't owe anybody an explanation. But I just seems odd to me. Several of them that have it, you know, Arlen Bruce. Who else has not? I mean, is it still just Jacobs and Keegan Johnson that have committed elsewhere?
Yeah.
Ugh.
Yeah,
interesting.
Jacob Justin and Justin Jacobs, so, and then that's it.
So, I agree. I don't think we're done with the portal. Here's the biggest question: it's the elephant in the room that we're still talking about because we've not seen anything on it. Do you think, if you had to guess, do you think Brian Ferentz is the offensive coordinator come spring ball?
If I had to lay odds, I would say we're probably 75% that he's going to be. I mean, there's a couple of things that have to happen. I think I was listening, and I know I shouldn't bring the information on, but from another podcast. But there's a lot.
No, I don't know.
I guess, what's his name? Coached Penn State. Now he's the offensive coordinator at Alabama.
Bill O'Brien?
He's not going to be back next year. At Alabama.
At Alabama?
The rumor is he's going to be back at New England taking back the offensive reins for them, and they'll need an offensive line coach. And he's really close with Brian Ferentz. That's really the only rumor out there right now if there was going to be a change. We're going to have to wait till, you know, late January when, you know, basically Black Friday when the season's over, when all the coaches start getting fired. Or even the playoffs, depending on if New England makes the playoffs or not. So,
I just don't. I'm sorry. I'm not as down on him as a lot of folks are. But it doesn't mean that I still think he should. I just don't think. I don't see how we could justify keeping him. I really don't.
Well,
you know,
I agree with you.
I mean,
making it merely $1 million a year.
Yeah. Well, that I don't begrudge him. I mean, you know, you got to keep assistants, and you got to keep assistants happy, but.
I'm just saying the return on investment is not there what we're doing. I mean, you can name on one hand the great games that he's called, and you lose count of all the ones that he's done a horrible job of.
Yeah. Well, and again, though, a lot of that does come down to O-line, but he was our O-line coach for a while and our run game coordinator. His dad is an O-line guru.
Yep.
So, I think, you know, I mean, I know it's not an easy situation. You know, it's just not. But I just don't know how we can. I just don't, you know.
Yeah,
now,
I'm with you.
Talk about Seth Anderson. Have you seen much tape on him?
Yeah, I watched a couple of his. He had two of them up on his 24/7 Sports for his transfer, and one of them it looked more like a great like possession guy, somebody that can get open, can get a few extra yards after the catch. So I'm like, all right, this is, you know, it's something we need. It would be beautiful to have somebody that was a 4-3 guy that could just burn and can catch everything. But I'm like, we just need guys that can catch the ball, get open. But then I saw another tape of them, and there's a couple of them where he did crossing routes or just went right down the hash and burned people. I mean, his dad's Flipper Anderson. I mean, he was one of the fastest wide receivers in the league back in the day. So if he has even three-quarters of what his dad had, that'd be great.
Yeah, definitely. So what do you see? What losses do you see are crucial? Obviously, Van Ness is going to be.
Yeah, Van Ness, you know, I looked at, I thought, about, I when I this, I knew you were going to ask this question. I thought about it. Van Ness is not as a big a loss as, say, when we lost AJ Epenesa a couple years ago, because there was such, that was, there wasn't much left on that defensive line, because you had Anthony Nelson go pro the year before that. Then you had AJ, and those were our two big pass rushers. And with,
plus Matt Nelson, I think, at the time.
Yeah, Matt Nelson, and then you, but this rotation of off defensive linemen that, I mean, you looked at how Deontay Craig looked unstoppable in that Music City Bowl.
Yeah, he did.
Ethan Herkett is now back to full strength. Y.A. Black now is starting to play to his potential. It is a huge loss, but I don't think it's as big of a loss as it would have been in the past, where we were very four guys and then six or seven that can kind of play, you know, that we've had in the past. I feel we can still go 8-9 deep and be fine. And, you know, they're also looking at Rodney Filer's son, who plays for Iowa Western. He was the whatever division it is. He's the defensive player of the year there. He had like 22 sacks. And he's going to come in as like he would be another Joe Evans style.
Okay.
You know,
okay.
Type of he's visiting this week also.
Indy Hawk just put in the chat room that Joe Evans is still coming back next year.
Yep, he has made it official on Twitter today that he's going to come back for one more year.
Awesome, that is awesome.
It's just giving us role players that can help bring along these young guys. You know.
Yeah. What about
there's only one left on my wish list? Yeah, well, Seth Beston would be my wish list for coming back, but I don't see that happening.
No, I don't either. I don't know what his draft grade is, though, so.
Yeah.
That's kind of hard. I'm utmost confidence in Jay Higgins, and I would have really loved a Jay Higgins, Justin Jacobs linebacker, you know, but that ship sailed.
The coaches have a lot of, they have a lot of Kyler Fisher. And is that his last name? I can never remember. But they have a lot of confidence in those two guys that are coming in that they can, you know, fill the shoes. And I mean, not to the Campbell's extent or, you know, athleticism of Jacobs, but I think, you know, I don't think it's going to be a liability next year.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, it really starts up front on our defense. I mean, we've had years where we have great backs, you know, a great back seven, so to speak, but up front we're just not deep enough, you know. I mean, several years where we were supposed to be great, part of what happened was injuries on our defensive line, you know. So that's I wouldn't be a lot more comfortable with Justin Jacobs staying, but I'm really positive on Jay Higgins. I just think he showed a lot. Unfortunately for him, he was playing behind two really, you know, one, you know, stud linebacker in Jack Campbell and a very, very, very good linebacker in Seth Benson. So, I mean, you know, it's kind of hard to shine in that. And it shows you the kind of talent level that Justin Jacobs had, that he was able to do that. So, you know,
I'm with you.
Yeah. If you had to guess, would you say Arlen Bruce goes or not?
I he's still in the portal. There hasn't been any rumblings of him pulling his name out. So I still think he goes. It'd probably be, again, if you were going to make it a percentage, 70% go, 30% chance he could come back. Because he's been very positive about everything and still supporting everybody. So I think the door is open. But
yeah. I mean, here's my problem with it. You know, Dallas Kratis is a fine example. He wanted to stay and play. He's a grad transfer, I think, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
You know, he played. I don't get why some of the other guys – now, I get, you know, if you're really serious, why you wouldn't play in a Justin Case situation, which leads me to believe that that's why I would be – you know, I would agree probably that that's why he's leaving. He didn't stay for the bowl game. He didn't, you know, did suit up or anything like that. So there's probably no – no chance or whatsoever. So, but on the other hand, I mean, we got this, you know, Seth Anderson. I still think we're looking at probably another wide receiver. Maybe not, because we did have
I think we get two. I think we've got three to four, depending on if Deacon Hill is a preferred walk-on or if he's actually getting a scholarship. I think if we have three or four slots open, I think we're at 82 or 81. I think we're at 81 when Carson May declared for the portal. So I think we had four spots open. So I really think, you know, I think on the wish list is one or two more wide receivers, a linebacker, and an offensive lineman, maybe a corner, or maybe only one wide receiver then. So
yeah, I would say we need to be looking at two offensive linemen, but who knows? What about the guys that have left Alabama, speaking of offensive line? Are we in the picture on any of them or no?
No, not that I've seen.
Yeah. I mean, I just haven't – you said there was one, though, guy from Stanford. Is that the only one we're really in on, or –
Yeah, from what I can tell right now, he's the only one that we've that's coming in for a visit, or that's actual, not just following them on Twitter. That's what I do. I've got there's a person on Twitter that tweets out every time a coach follows a player in the portal.
Yeah.
So that's where I get my first bit of information, and then I go to the different like 24/7 in that. But yeah, that's the only one that's actually been like official contact and set up a visit with.
Yeah. And do you think, you know, we're talking about offensive coordinator, but I'm not so sure our offensive line coach should be on the hot seat. And frankly, you know, I know we've gotten good receivers before, but I don't know why Kelton Copeland seems to be immune from any kind of pressure, you know? I mean,
I'm with you on Barnett. I'm definitely with you. I've been voicing that since the first game of the season when the offensive line looked horrible. Kelvin Copeland, my only thing is the way he kind of voiced his frustrations of like he has to work with what we recruit. And I think we are changing our recruiting of wide receivers after he made that vocal, because he was having to deal with people that were more physical, were great blockers and receivers second. I mean, Marcette and Brandon Smith were the exception to that rule, but it seems like most of the times that's the formula they look for is somebody that can block downfield for the running game, and that doesn't always equate to being a good wide receiver. You know, if we're going to do that, let's put five tight ends out there and see what happens, you know?
Right, exactly.
So
it'll be interesting to see.
Thing. Yeah, and he's got a good – I like the recruits we've got coming in at wide receiver. Blewett and then is it Davis? Dayton. Dayton and Blewett look great. And Alex Moda, he's an athlete, you know, so he could play a bunch of different spots. He could be the next Bruce, you know, that jet sweep guy. So, I mean, look at what he can do with his talent.
I saw him interviewed on Corey Bratta's podcast, the Hawkeye of the Storm, is up on YouTube, which is a good cast, by the way. So I'm not telling people to abandon me, but Corey Brada does good work. And also, by the way, Don Patterson on that appears with him at post game. But Corey Brada had interviewed Alex Moda, and he just seemed like he's just really excited to, you know, to be there, and he's ready to start working with guys. You know, I mean, that's half the battle, I think, is the attitude you know, as they're coming in. You know, he wasn't saying, you know, what you're going to see from me on the field. He's, you know, other than he said, you know, I'm going to give it my all and I'm going to do my best to fit in, you know, where I'm needed. You know, I just – that made me feel a little more – you know, that he's not looking to join the transfer portal for the next NIL dollar, so to speak.
Yeah,
so.
He's coming in to be – he could be wide receiver. He could be a corner, you know. So he just wants, hey, tell me where you think I can help the team. And that's the that's Cooper DeVine again, all over again. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So.
No, absolutely. But I just, so maybe the recruiting will help. But I just don't, you know, our receivers, for the most part, we haven't had guys getting open all over the place. Of course, it's hard to know whether we really did have guys getting open all over the place because our line was so terrible this year.
Yeah.
Oh, speaking of, though, What are your thoughts on Spencer Petras saying that he is staying? He's going to be on the roster, but he's all but said he's not going to be able to play, I guess, because of recovery. Why would we let him take up a scholarship if we know he's not going to play? Or do you think he's just going to be moved around?
Is he said he's going to be actually back for the 23 season, or is he going to just be there through
the spring? He said the 23 season.
Okay. But I've also seen where he said he understands he's not going to play, and he sees himself possibly being a coach in the future.
I would agree. I think he has always acquitted himself well in interviews. And he's obviously smarter. Some things I think break down. But again, I think most of that is the O-line. So that's where we're going to need to.
True.
And see, T. Bodhi said it in the chat room again. Junior must go, meaning Brian, I assume. People have said, well, what about, maybe they'll just get rid of our offensive line coach and keep Brian that way. That's not a good optic, any future assistant coach is going to start thinking, well, God, I could get bounced around for the next Ferentz that's in line or whatever. I think Brian's got to go. I don't know how we do it. Don Patterson made the point that, first of all, he said, for everybody that says, oh, he's just running Kirk's offense, he says, Kirk has a philosophy, but Kirk doesn't have an offense. He said, Kirk's not running the day-to-day. He says, for people that think Kirk's in there every day, he goes, wrong. He goes, the head coach doesn't have the time to be doing that. What the head coach will do, and he said this of Hayden Fry, he said, what the head coach does do is he says, what can I do for you to make, this coming game better? How can I help? Where am I needed? Where are you stumbling? Well, Brian's got, stumbling in every direction, from every position, not every position, but he's got to go. I think he's just got to go. And I don't know how they do it. Patterson said really what it is got to be is Bart has got to go to Kirk. He's got to have the guts to go to Kirk and say, help me out here, Help me out here.
Well,
so
let's not bring up Barta because he's already blocked the growth of the program with what he's doing with the NIL. I know it has opened up and what he said, but I just don't think Barta – I'm not a Barta fan. Even if people called for his head and said, you can stay only if you tell Kirk to fire Brian, or you just go ahead and fire Brian, I don't think he would do it.
I don't know. That's a hard one to call. His record with by the way, his employment, as HR, his HR record is not good, obviously. I mean, losing that lawsuit, but.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know how they do it. I hope you're right that Bill O'Brien becomes the next coach anywhere and takes Brian with him. I mean, that would be an easy way for it. And maybe that's all we're waiting for. Maybe it's just I think you would hear from offensive recruits if they, don't come our way if it was a Brian issue. I think you would hear that. Proctor tried to make that statement. A lot of it was the offense too, but not always. He was just doing what Alabama people.
He backtracked on a lot of stuff anyway too, since he said that he was settling.
Oh, he has. What more has he said?
I'm trying to remember what it was, but he basically, it was more of he wanted to play for championships more than settling at Iowa over, because he knew he would never play for national championships at Iowa. He'd have to be at a place like Alabama to do that, which I will give him some kudos to what he says with that. It's true. He wouldn't have done that at Oregon. He wouldn't have done that at Iowa. Those are the top three. So, saving face a little bit, but if he really – it's out there that he said that he settled with Iowa, so.
Yeah, and I think his new coaches are probably cringing at that, but it is what it is. So did you see the Michigan, not their fumble, but their touchdown? Was it a long pass touchdown?
That was a touchdown. 100% a touchdown.
And so they lose that scoring opportunity. I don't, I mean, I, you know, a lot of things happen through a game, so you can't blame one single play ever. But by the same token, it's like, what the hell? I mean, you have that touchdown taken away, and then you lose the ball. I mean, you know, just like what if our touchdown had been called against or had not been overturned against Iowa State? How that would have changed that game, you know? I mean, it's a
– Exactly, the fumble.
Yeah, the same type of deal. Now, I did not see the – I haven't even seen video of the Ohio State one. What was that controversy? There was a hit on Marvin Harrison Jr.?
Yeah, that one I have more flex because I don't even, don't get me started on the whole targeting thing because there was a lot of bad ones that weren't called or not upheld, but they called it, they reviewed it, and it was more of a face mask to, you know, maybe upper chest face mask, lower face mask area of the, of Marvin Harrison Jr., but it was a brutal hit. It could have been at least been called of like, you know, what is it they call it, the when they're before they make a football move, it's the
defenseless player.
Yeah, defenseless player. It could have almost been a defensive player type of call in that aspect.
Yeah. Well, after seeing what I did see, I'm not all that convinced Georgia is that, you know, invincible.
I don't either. I'm with you. You know, you were talking about the Michigan game and the fumble that wasn't a fumble. It should have been a touchdown. There was a horrible targeting that was overturned at the end of that game that would have given them, you know, a better chance to score. I mean, crown of the helmet to the back of the helmet neck area of a Michigan wide receiver, and they said it wasn't targeting. That's the one rule that they need to fix or just get rid of because it's not called correctly or reviewed correctly. I mean, it's horrible.
Case in point, that, you know, the play that that resulted in Cooper DeJean going out in the Nebraska game, that guy clearly, you know, put his head down and then rammed it up at his head. You know, I mean, how was that not called? And supposedly, you know, they could call from the review for things like that, and they don't. I mean, something's just wrong there. I mean, it's what instant replay was supposed to give us was a little bit of assurance that stuff would be corrected, and it's not happening like that. They're making decisions up there, sort of
the
like
eye
you
in
know,
the sky, making sure things aren't missed.
Yeah, but instead, it's the eye of the sky now. You know, imposing on the game is how I see it, but who knows? I mean, I guess I just, you know, that's – so here's another thing. I don't know if you were on when I mentioned this. An NCAA committee has recommended that in championship events, 25% of schools be allowed to compete, which would have a 32-team playoff in football.
So participation trophy.
Well, you know, here's the thing. I mean, like March Madness would be like 90 teams because, you know, there's like roughly 360 teams, so it would be 90 teams. Well, look, I don't see number 90 beating number one, but, you know, that was before Virginia lost as a one seed, you know. I mean, things could happen in basketball, a little less in football, I would say, but upsets do happen. I mean, I think if they – revamp the bowl system to incorporate it into a 32-team playoff, then it's a lot more palatable. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's just...
Yeah, I'm with you on that. And I think we've had this conversation multiple times because then you don't lose the pageantry and the history of the bowl game, but make it more relevant. I mean, we talked about it on Saturday. I mean, how many of these people are going to sit out, you know, because they're going pro. So,
well, did you hear the other thing?
No, what's that?
Well, that bowls might be able to offer NIL money to players to induce them to play in their bowl games.
We even talked about that.
Yeah.
Could they do?
You know, it would be a matter of, you know, the schools getting – in other words, they'd allocate it for players. I mean, I think that's a great idea if they, you know, allocate it for certain players. I mean, as you said last week, you know, part of it's going to have to be NIL. I mean, if I'm, you know, Hank's car dealership in Cedar Rapids, and I've got guys coming, you know, signing deals and coming to sign autographs or whatever, one of the things I want to know is that you're playing in all your games. You know, I'm also doing this because it gives, you know, it brings me, theoretically, it brings customers in the door. But, you know, one of the things I want to be able to say is, hey, I am sponsoring, you know, we are sponsoring Joe Schmo, you know, Heisman finalist and Orange Bowl participant Joe Schmo. I mean, that's the kind of thing that NIL will have to do. So, and that's the problem with NIL as we see it right now, is the collectives and everything else. It's not really NIL. It's pay for play under the guise of NIL. Mm-hmm. But it's, you know, like somebody said, I would want to see what specifically is, well, how, look at our team. What specifically is, you know, as an example, Caleb Johnson doing to earn NIL money? I think that's a legit question.
Yep.
I mean, you know, remember years ago it was, oh, all they're doing is turning on the stadium lights and they get paid for it. Well, okay, is that what's happening here, or is there actual name, image, and likeness in use here? That's what it's, you know, to me. And that's why a collective, what is a collective getting out of it? You know what I mean? I mean, it's not a sponsorship. It's not, you know, a business relationship. And I think that's where we have a problem. So,
mm-hmm.
Say lovey, and so it goes. Hey, we're down to we're down near the end, so I got to just close off with a few things. But
not a worry.
Thanks for calling in. We'll talk more, of course. And go Hawks. Are you going to follow basketball, or are you going to follow basketball enough, or are you kind of just after the last couple games?
They gave me hope in the second half of the Penn State game. I mean, they almost made that happen. So we'll see. Interesting stepping away because of the anxiety issues, and we'll see how that plays out and everything. So, but no, I'll still watch it. Maybe try to set up some game watches for us also.
Yeah. It's just harder with weeknight games and stuff like that. It's just not as easy for working people to do that, but you know, still, you know, well, we'll talk again, and thanks for being on. We'll talk more.
You're welcome,
and go Hawks.
Go Hawks. Talk to you later.
Bye. That is, I call him Histrionic Mike on my phone. I also call him Avid Mike. He is a vociferous Hawkeye. He doesn't carry a flag. Maybe he does, but he doesn't carry a flag, I don't think, around the stadium like T. Bodie used to. T. Bodie used to have the world's largest Hawkeye flag, I swear. It was also used, I believe, to smuggle contraband beer into the stadium. That's what the rumor was. I never caught him at it, but anyway, Mike is Mike follows recruiting as well. I don't follow recruiting the way he does. I know Indy Hawk follows it a little bit too. I don't follow that side of it as much. I like, you know, I like to follow just the setup and stuff. So fun to talk to. In the meantime, folks, I'm getting ready to cut out. Thanks for being here. We will be back next week at 5:30. I want to thank T. Bodie and Indy Hawk in the chat room, Sue from New Mexico, and my big sister on the phones for a while. The usual two numbers that I don't recognize. I think they are spies. I think they're government spies. Who knows? In the meantime, let's send you off with some little Gino Vannelli. And have a good week, folks.
My, what a marvelous sight. Wear your pants and leather shoes. You gotta win and never lose. Oh, and why, oh, why? Oh, Jack, I cry. If it happens to you today. Why such a glorious guy?
Good night, folks. Happy New Year, and God bless.
Bye-bye.